You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, a parenting writer says American mothers are held to unsustainable standards, and all the moms nod in agreement. We talk to her about her new book, Screaming on the Inside. Now, the Biden administration announced a series of steps yesterday it's taking to try and increase protections for renters. The president is directing federal agencies to examine practices that affect the rental market, including anti-competitive information sharing, how tenants are screened, and how background checks are run. The administration also released its blueprint for a renter's bill of rights, which would not be enforceable as a set of laws, but rather lay out the types of protections the administration would like to ensure. Some housing advocates say the Biden administration's moves don't go far enough and have been too slow, while groups representing landlords, property managers, and housing providers say additional regulations could create undue burdens that would end up hurting renters. So we want to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. Do you think the federal government needs to do more to protect renters? Are you a renter yourself or a property owner or property manager? Provide your perspective this afternoon with our story at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mitch is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And Mitch, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
What stood out to you yesterday from the proposals from the Biden administration?
Yeah, it's a very comprehensive, about a 15-page report that covers suggestions for literally everyone. So it's entitled The Renter's Bill of Rights. But what's really important here is that it actually should involve absolutely everyone, whether you're a renter, a homeowner, an advocate for renters, an advocate for property owners, city government, local government, state government. There's something in here for everyone. The big ones that stand out to me are sort of what they've outlined as principles 1, 3, and 5. There's five principles. It's about more housing, more education and enforcement of existing rights, and then more eviction prevention and diversion and relief. Those are the biggies for me, and I'm happy to dive into any of those. One more addition to my bio, in addition to teaching about rental housing law and practicing it, I also do own rental property. So I see it as an advocate for both renters, but also as somebody who owns and rents out properties.
So you understand both sides of this equation and the push and pull that exists there.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So let's start with more housing. What are some of the reasons we have we don't have enough housing for demand?
Right. Well, so I mean the principle here is to increase access to safe, quality, and accessible and affordable housing. And to get more affordable housing, we simply need more housing. Right. It's simple supply and demand. We don't build nearly enough. And if we had more housing, then property costs or the ability to rent would go down. But we slow down development, and I know that sounds sort of counterintuitive, but by slowing down development and stalling it out in certain places and not building housing and density as much as we could, what we end up doing is making the existing housing stock just smaller and having costs go up. We end up building, pushing developers to build in places where they can, where it's easier to build, but that isn't accessible. It's far outside of town. It's not on transportation routes, and that doesn't help anyone either. And so what we end up doing by trying to sort of protect people is slowing down, protecting neighborhoods, and we get into sort of some NIMBYism. That ends up building costs up and housing gets more and more expensive. And so if you really, I know there are a lot of people who believe in affordable housing and increasing density and increasing diversity, but then they think, oh, you know, but I don't want to live right next to it. And that's the thing. Like I said, there's something for everybody here, not just policymakers. You have to, I know the city of Madison is looking at changing its zoning code to allow more density. And in order to do that, you know, it will in fact bring housing more affordable, but it's very hard to sort of vote against or contact your local council person and sort of say, well, you know, I'm willing to have change in my neighborhood. I'm willing to do that. That's one of the difficult things that this outlines and suggests as something to be done. You know, the Biden administration isn't sort of forcing folks to do this, but is laying out principles that in order to increase housing safety, quality, accessibility, and affordability, we need to build more of it.
But as a property owner, the limit on the number of houses would increase your value. So that would be, as an investment, be seen as a good return, right? Well, as a property owner, the limited housing that's available would increase your value as a property investment.
Sure, sure. If we don't build more housing down here, I can charge higher rents. But I'm not interested. I'm not interested in charging higher rents. I'm interested in having a community and living in a community that I love, that has people of diverse backgrounds and diverse levels of incomes. And so we need to embrace that, and it means embracing some change and having more housing built in accessible areas. And you know, moving to the next one, you know, we have to have education and enforcement and enhancement of existing rights. A big thing that I like to talk about whenever given the opportunity, part of it's because I'm an educator, but in order to own rental property in state of Wisconsin, you don't need a license. You need a license to teach people. You need a license, you know, to be a teacher. You need a license to cut hair. You need a license to drive a car. You don't need a license to evict people. It's shocking to me. I litigate cases, and over and over and over again, I'm litigating cases with business people who don't know basic rental housing laws because they don't have to take any tests, they don't have to take any education, and they do things that might seem intuitive, but there are smart regulations designed to help renters and owners, and they don't know about them, and they end up learning the hard way by going to court and being on the other end of a lawsuit. So if we had some minimal education or encouraged education, which is what this does, we have education for both renters and owners, we'd have a lot less disputes in court. And again, that's maybe bad for me, but I would love to see a less litigious a rental housing market where we actually work things out and don't have to end up in court.
Yeah, I was just thinking of education from the renter's side. I wasn't considering what education could do for property owners and the opportunities that would be that would exist for them if they knew what was available.
That's absolutely right.
Mitch is our guest. He is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're taking a look at the Biden administration's proposal out yesterday to help renters with a blueprint for a renter's bill of rights. Want to know what you think, whether you're a property owner, property manager, or you're a renter, especially in a college town like Madison, where we are this afternoon, where people are already re-signing their lease for the 2023-2024 rental season. What's that like for you to have to plan 8 months ahead for folks who are renting month to month with their check? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Then there's eviction prevention. What can the Biden administration do that would improve the scenarios for keeping people in their homes or keeping people in the rented properties, Mitch?
Yeah, so a couple of things that so a lot of this is outlining proposals that it suggests local governments or state governments enact, but there's also charging various different federal agencies to take some actions, and one of those is that some federal agencies are going to be charged with increasing the notice period. So a lot of times evictions happen and people get displaced and then they become a burden and their costs go up and it becomes much harder for them to be productive and to provide, you know, just basic services and a roof over their head for their children if they're evicted quickly. And the suggestion in here and that several federal agencies are enacting is a 30 for federal housing and housing that receives some federal funding is a 30-day notice before an eviction can be filed. Yeah, that's six times more notice than the state of Wisconsin requires. In Wisconsin, you get a 5-day notice and then an eviction can be filed. 30 days notice is what is suggested here. It's what some states apply, but every state is different. And so this is encouraging much more notice so that people can plan if they find themselves, you know, because they've lost their job or there's been a terrible sickness in their family or some other change in their family structure such that they're going to have to move out, right? Moving out when you get a 5-day notice and then an eviction is filed against you, that's next to impossible to do that while you're dealing with that, say, family health crisis, that loss of a job, that domestic violence sort of situation. And the other thing in here on eviction prevention and diversion that's really big is that it outright says eviction case filing should be immediately sealed, including so that people who are just have an eviction filed against them don't have that record used against them as they seek future housing. Think if you're abused and suddenly you try to get out or away from an abuser, but you're looking for housing and there's an eviction filing on your record, that is a technically legal reason to be denied housing. So everybody can turn you down because they say, oh, I see an eviction has been filed. It looks like you probably didn't pay your rent, when in reality, you are the victim of a horrible crime, or you're just simply the victim of a layoff from a job. Nothing that's your fault, but because those records are immediately public, they are misused. And that goes back and loops into the education, is that people, you know, again, it seems intuitive that you wouldn't want to rent to somebody with an eviction on their record, but no one trains owners in a thorough way or licenses them to actually dig deeper and screen people better. And so they resort to just looking on our court record website and evicting, or excuse me, denying housing to people in situations because those records are immediately available and those records are misunderstood and misused. And technically that's legal.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Mitch, the director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We'll start with Doug in Colfax. Doug, good afternoon.
Hi. My question is, I'm a landlord, and I wonder about the laws, too. Your guest said that there isn't any training required or licensing. Is there a place like a State of Wisconsin website where I could easily access landlord rental laws? Thank you.
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, so the state, the closest that we come is the state has a big department. It's in charge of agriculture, trade, and consumer protection. So that's a large group of things that that department has to oversee. But we call it DATCAP for short, Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. If you look them up online, you can find their information. They technically regulate rental housing and have issued some regulations and some guidance sheets and some general information. If you're it's available to everyone across the state. So there are a couple of good renter advocacy organizations, really advocacy organizations for rental housing, period, not just renters or owners. Tenant Resource Center is one in the city of Madison. And in Milwaukee, there's Community Advocates. They both have really good information available on their websites as well.
I've always considered them for renters. I didn't even consider them for property owners. Let's go to Sue in Washburn next. Sue, good afternoon.
Hi there. I know in other states, the landlords are held to a certain, you know, keeping their properties at a certain level, a certain standard. Why doesn't Wisconsin require their landlords to keep things fixed, to be able to be reachable if the tenant has an issue? I moved here 20-some years ago. I rented for a long time. I was able to purchase one of the rentals I was living in because I was really tired of moving every couple of years for whatever reason of the landlords. And, you know, it's just something that these younger people cannot find a decent place to live because the rent is outrageous and the properties are just horrible. There's, you know, mold issue, whatever, wiring or whatever, or the landlord's not even reachable. So my kids, I'm letting them stay in my house. Even though one's an adult and one is going to be an adult graduating, and, you know, let them stay in my house for the next couple of years until they decide what else they want to do.
Sue, I appreciate the perspective. What about holding landlords to a standard of keeping their rentals in good shape? Is that something we do in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and again, it's one of the things suggested here where they're talking about increasing more housing. They're not just saying build it in shambles without any building codes. They're actually saying to increase access for safe and quality housing, and that's really important. I think the caller's point is very well taken. If you don't have quality housing, the housing itself can make you sick and end up leading to you being forced out because you have a leaky roof or mold or any other types of situations. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, and again, maybe if we looked at some of this guidance and had better communication, but unfortunately in Wisconsin, the ability of local municipalities to, or even counties to pass laws requiring inspection of rental housing was greatly curtailed in 2015. A law was passed that took away cities and counties' abilities to do what they call routine program inspections to make sure that rental housing stock was safe for renters. So now it's still available to do, and there are hardworking building inspection officials in a lot of cities that do that work, but they can only do it if renters are educated and know to call. They can't do it just to sort of make sure that everybody in the city is safe. You have to call and ask for it.
We're talking with UW-Madison Law School Professor Mitch about protections for renters and new proposals from the Biden administration. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Are you glad to see the Biden administration taking these steps? Would you like to see the White House do more or perhaps less? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation next, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and now we're picking up our conversation with Mitch. He's a law professor at UW-Madison, here today to look at the Biden administration's proposed protections for renters and what it could mean for tenants and property managers alike. And you're welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you're a landlord or a property manager. What do you think of all this? You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And Mitch, with the proposals from the Biden administration yesterday, what power would the federal government have to implement any of this? How much power does the state have? How much power do local municipalities have? When it all breaks down, who's going to have to take action to make things change?
Yeah, so the federal government has a decent amount of power because they finance so many home loans. And so the loans is where a lot of new restrictions that are proposed, or sort of smart regulations, if you will, that are proposed, sort of thoughtful things, are being proposed, which is the 30-day notice. So for federally financed housing, it's being suggested that, there be an actual 30-day notice before evictions are filed. And additionally, a number of agencies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the FTC, Housing and Urban Development, the USDA, which again we think is agriculture, but they actually provide a lot of rural housing under the USDA, are all being asked or tasked to step up and provide more sort of smart regulations to make sure that we have access to safe, quality, accessible, affordable housing, and that people on all sides of this, owners, renters, and people who are neighbors, are really understanding some of the dynamics. The local municipalities still have some powers here in Wisconsin, but a lot were preempted by state law. So a lot of the ability to take action at the state level is in the hands of our state legislature and governor. And then as far as eviction sort of sealing of records and eviction prevention and things, there's a lot of power to a certain degree in the courts. So that's another place where I'm at a lot when I'm not teaching at the law school is going to court. And judges have a lot of ability to right now to seal records of eviction filings. And in some cases they are. And in other cases they are not sealing those records, which, as I mentioned, can sometimes really lead to tragic situations where people are – we just had a case in court this past week where somebody who is living sort of in church shelters right now from one place to the other with herself and her children, and the court denied a request to seal her housing, her eviction case, when it was right during the height of COVID, when there was no vaccines, and so she did not move out. And again, it's really no fault of anybody here that no one caused the pandemic, but that record is now haunting her and preventing her from finding new housing.
Let's go back to your calls now. 1-800-642-1234, where Angie and Mays O'Maney is standing by. Angie, good afternoon.
Hi. I don't know whether it's a question. Maybe good advice would be helpful. My daughter's 27. She's a single mom. She's been renting for 3.5 years. She's a Montessori school teacher. She never paid her rent late. She's been a perfect tenant. Her landlord sent her a saying that she apologized first and then told her.
Yeah, you're cutting out, Angie, but I have the gist here that her daughter has to be out of the house by March 1st, and I'm sorry we're not able to ask any follow-up questions here, Mitch, because of the connection, and I apologize to you, Angie, through no fault of our own, but Mitch, where would you go for help if you were finding yourself looking at having to leave by March 1st through no fault of your own.
Yeah, so for Angie, who is calling from Mazo, if your daughter is also in Dane County, again, the Tenant Resource Center is a great local resource, and they have links up to the legal service or legal aid providers that serve Madison and Dane County pretty regularly. Those include places like Community Justice, Legal Action of Wisconsin, the law school clinics that I work at, are a few handful of good resources to potentially reach out and ask some follow-up questions to.
Yeah, Michelle from Green Bay couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know where renters can go if they want an inspection done.
Call your local building inspection office. And then when I say this, I'm cognizant that, you know, the city of Madison, city of Milwaukee, there's a building inspector, there's a division of neighborhood services or Bureau of Neighborhood Services in Milwaukee. Not every city or county has a building inspector who will inspect rental housing property. Oftentimes it's just building of new housing where they approve plumbing and electrical. But if you don't have one, first call City Hall. Ask, see if they have a building inspector, see if they'll inspect rental housing. And if they don't, you can, in fact, talk to your local city council person, alder person. I have a great anecdote about the village of Lowell, where they once, less than 400 people lived there, but they were contacted by someone who complained about their rental housing, really terrible situation. And the village passed a resolution to hire a building inspector to inspect that one a handful of properties that were really, really shoddy. And so the laws are available for inspectors to respond to complaints. And if there aren't inspectors, city governments can, in fact, pass, ordinances or resolutions to hire folks to do that. So complain to your elected officials if you don't have a building inspector.
And Mitch, we've got about a minute left, but what are you looking for next after the announcement from the Biden administration yesterday?
Well, as an optimist, I'm looking forward to a lot more work and a lot more sort of communication. I think this short 15-page document is pretty dense, and it suggests a lot of things that, again, everyone needs to do. It's not just advocates. It's not just renters. It's not just owners. It's not judges alone or building inspectors alone, but everybody really has to slow down and think about how can we maintain and how can we build better and how can we get to a place where we have safe, accessible, affordable housing for everybody and we're not kicking people out thoughtlessly. We're doing we're working within the market, but we're doing that thoughtfully and humanely. So I think that only happens with better communication.
Hey, Mitch, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Mitch is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. With us today to discuss protections for rental property tenants and new renter protections proposed by the Biden administration yesterday. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, meet the clinical psychologist surveying hundreds of Black and Hispanic teens about their social media use and find out how it's affected their emotional well-being and academic performance. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, an insider view from this year's Sundance Film Festival. Hear from the world's best-known and lesser-known directors about the movies being shown to an eager and critical crowd, plus the latest from the Vatican on the LGBTQ community. Now, the pandemic changed a lot of things about parenting. School closures meant many had to juggle work and remote schooling, and for a time, a lot of parents lost the help they got from support networks, like grandparents and babysitters. For a lot of parents, those expectations felt unrealistic. Our next guest says that's particularly true for mothers. And in a new book, she says what's expected of American mothers was already unsustainable long before COVID-19. We're listening back to that conversation now, but you can still let us know about your experience with motherhood. If you're a mom yourself, do you struggle with feelings like you have to live up to unreasonable standards? What are those standards and where do they come from? For everyone who can better support the mothers in our personal lives and our work lives, let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Gross writes a newsletter on parenting for the New York Times opinion section. Her new book is Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. And she recently talked with Central Times' Rob Ferret. Here's a listen.
You write that in the U.S., mothers in a lot of ways are on their own. And this, in a lot of ways, started for you with your experience during your first pregnancy. Can you tell us about how reality quickly steered away from some of the ideals we might see?
Sure. So I was very sick during my pregnancy with my older daughter. I had just taken a new job. I found out I was pregnant on my second day of work. And then I proceeded to get extremely sick with hyperemesis, which is extreme morning sickness. And I was so sick, I could not stay in that job. And there were very few legal protections around me, which is unusual. In other peer nations that are as wealthy as the United States, parents have a lot more structures around them, including nationalized health care, including paid leave. So I had none of those things because I live in the United States. And while I knew about the limitations of public policy for parents and had reported on some of them before I got pregnant myself, actually living through it really brought it home to me in a very real way and kind of set me off on a path to think deeply about why we make it so much harder than in other wealthy nations to raise children and what might make it better. And I think what happened with the pandemic was many, many more people realized the many ways in which our country makes it difficult to raise children. I mean, one thing we don't even think about, but is so woven into our daily lives, is simply that the school day does not match the typical workday. So starting from there, every single day for parents who need to work to support their families is a puzzle piece of hours, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, from your own experience, and you talk to other moms in the present day and read diaries from the last couple hundred years of American motherhood, it seems like in some ways the first rule of, you know, facing challenges as a mom is you don't talk publicly. You don't complain about the challenges you face as a mom. That's judged negatively. What kind of themes did you see when it came to even the ability to talk about these problems?
Well, so I absolutely adored reading these old diaries and letters because the emotions, especially around early motherhood, are eternal. So I remember most vividly a 19th century mom writing, I believe, in a letter to her sister that if she thought that she had to nurse a child for the rest of her life, she would, quote, lie down and die. Because she was so exhausted and she just couldn't imagine the stress and sleeplessness for ongoing forever. And they expressed the joys and the pains, but it certainly wasn't something that they would ever talk about publicly. This was all private communication, again, in diaries, in letters to only their closest intimate friends or sisters or mothers. And there's a lot of historical precedent for any time women would speak out about the difficulties they were experienced, they would get pushback. In some very disturbing cases in the mid-20th century, they were made to feel like there was something psychiatrically wrong with them. So in the sort of pronatalist push post-World War II, it was psychiatrically in vogue to tell women that if they didn't feel well during pregnancy or had doubts about their newborns, that they were neurotic and that they needed mental help. And they hated their own femininity. There was something wrong with them. So throughout history, there have been moments where just simply being honest about different kinds of feelings around motherhood have really been demonized.
You'd like to think that has changed, but you're a woman, a mom, writing about these challenges in the world where the internet exists. What have you encountered?
So it's really a range. I think today, more than ever, there is space and validation for a huge range of motherhood experiences. And I've heard from so many moms who really feel that they've been saved by internet groups where women have experienced what they've gone through. And then in other ways, there's just the nastiness and the trollishness that hits every other topic. But I think the difference with especially new parents is they just feel so vulnerable. So while you might be able to brush off a troll or more easily in other aspects of your life or other life choices you might make, I think especially that new parent moment, you're so vulnerable and exhausted. I think it's harder to deal with the various streams of information that are just coming at your face from every direction on the internet.
Talking to Jessica Gross, her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. She says the image sometimes often doesn't match up with the reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see If you're a mom or you know one, what do you see as some of the unrecognized challenges of being a mom in this day and age? Or if you're looking back at your own life in your era of motherhood, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You mentioned that idea of blame. And in the World War II era, you talk about moms being blamed for the way they parented kids who had problems later, sons, after coming back from World War II and having trauma from World War II. That idea that you're going to be blamed for decisions you make, I don't think that's gone away. Can you talk about some of the things you encounter in the present day?
Well, so the example I use in the book is parents fretting over what is the first milk that they introduce to their toddlers. So I have just read so many internet threads where people are like, should it be whole milk? Should it be 1%? Should I even give my child dairy? Should it be plant milk? And there's this intense feeling that this choice is both extremely consequential and that also if something goes wrong with your children's health, it will be your fault. And I just think that that's underlying many, many decisions that we make along the way, again, especially when our kids are really little, because my kids are now 6 and 10, and they make a lot of decisions for themselves that I obviously have no control over. So I think a lot of that sort of concentrated anxiety around sort of every little thing mattering so much is really around those early years.
And it seems like across the political spectrum, someone might judge a mom for working while being a mom, or not using organic milk while being a mom, or fill in the blank with various parts. Can we dial down the judginess? Is that part of the problem here?
I mean, I would really hope so. I think part of the problem is when these interactions are happening online, we don't have the context of each other's lives, right? I mean, certainly I've witnessed and heard about interactions in real life where people are being judged, but mostly people, I like to believe that people will just mind their own business and live and let live. And I think when you have the context of someone and their real humanity, people are not quite so quick to judge when you're just seeing this one decision that someone perhaps made without any context about who they are, or who their children is, or what their family circumstances are.
That's other people judging moms. You write that you and many other moms struggle with judging themselves. They've seen, you know, these ideals of perfect moms out there. It seems like it'd be easier said than done to just ignore all that.
Oh, yeah. I am not suggesting that it is easy or that it's even possible to shut it all out. I think what I hope people take away from the book and from listening to us chat on the radio is anytime they feel that judgment or guilt or questioning themselves, they have to feel the feeling, but they can sit with it and say, what are my values? Are these somebody else's values? Do I even respect these values? Just sit and think about, why am I feeling this way, rather than having that guilt necessarily be a compass that guides them, if it isn't even something that they really deeply care about.
We're talking to Jessica Gross, who writes about parenting for the New York Times. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, your own experience, maybe during pregnancy or raising kids? What did you see as some of the biggest challenges? Did you feel supported enough as a mom? What was missing, if not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with New York Times parenting writer Jessica Gross about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a mom yourself, if you're raising a kid right now or want to look back at your experience 10, 20, 30 years ago, you name it, love to hear what you saw as the biggest challenges, how you dealt with them, the places where the images and the expectations of moms didn't match up with the reality. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about the loss of the support system for young families. I'm 67 years old, and when I had my children, my mother was there to help me. She actually stayed. She and my father stayed for the first month with my oldest one. I was clueless as to how to take care of a baby. I was the youngest in the family and never saw a baby raised. And, you know, so many young families now are separated geographically from extended family, and they don't have that ability to say, Mom, could you come over? The baby's sick. I don't know what to do. Or, you know, an older sister or somebody. You know, people are unprepared and unsupported, and it makes it very difficult for young families nowadays.
Gwen, thanks a lot for sharing that. Jessica, what do you think?
I completely agree. Part of the reason that we live in New York, despite the very high cost of living here, is that my parents are here. And during the pandemic, we moved in with them for part of the time. I don't know what I would have done without them. My lives and my children's lives would be so much less rich and beautiful without my parents so frequently in them. And you saw during the pandemic, anecdotally, it's more anecdotal than I've seen solid data to suggest, but I know so many people who move near family because that moment made them realize I want to have this multi-generational life, and that's the kind of the best way to raise children in community. Because I think part of the problem we have now is that even two parents, it's just not enough to meet all of the needs.
Gwen, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jessica, something else Gwen said along the way there was, like, starting off, she didn't know how to be a mom. And I think there's sometimes an assumption, an expectation, maybe a self-expectation that this is natural. So you're naturally going to know what to do during pregnancy, during early child raising, and that isn't necessarily so.
Well, what I would always say to my husband when we were brand new parents, if he would turn to me and the baby would be crying and he would say, why is she crying? What does she want? I would say, I don't know. I don't speak baby. And so I offer that to you. I did not invent that phrase. I can't remember where I got it, but it is very useful because you are learning, and every baby is different, and part of sort of the excitement and fear is you're learning about your individual baby. And so no one is an expert. I mean, certainly each child, it does get easier, but every kid is so different. You shouldn't have the idea that you're going to be an expert when you start with it, because it's something that you can only really learn through doing. And certainly caregiving for other babies is a way to practice, but once it's all you and it's 3 a.m. and there's nobody else around, you just kind of have to learn through experience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gwen. We'll go now to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon and Merry Christmas.
To you too.
This is a great topic to address at this time of year. My mother was a single parent, so I know the struggles of what it was like to see my mom raise kids through many ages. She had her last baby when she was 44. And from the bottom of my heart, I honestly believe as a society, it takes a village. I would like to see mothers or newborn babies receive the support they need financially from, you know, national health insurance or from our government to provide that safety net and help that people need. I would support that legislation.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Jessica, in your conclusion, you talk about some policy solutions that might help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think exactly what the caller is saying. I mean, national health insurance would go such a long way. I have friends who have given birth both in the United States and in European context, and it is night and day. They can't even believe the benefits of the systems around them, that, you know, nurses will visit your house when you're a new mother to make sure that you're getting along okay. There's nursing support. There's mothers groups that are, you know, supported by the government. I mean, there's just so much that we don't even know that we are missing out on that really helps mothers and fathers as well feel supported in those early days. I think, you know, paid leave, again, I don't think it's realistic to expect that the United States will ever be Sweden or Norway. It's always the Scandinavian countries that we talk about with the most generous benefits, but we do so little comparatively. Even 3 months of leave, which some states do provide, would be such a huge step in the right direction. And even as I was editing the book, two more states, I believe it was Delaware and Maryland, passed leave. So I do think we're going in the right direction. Childcare is another huge problem. There just is not enough to go around. I think there's a number of ways we could fix that. I think often the solution is just more paid childcare. But if we could support parents staying home for longer, there would be less of a need for childcare, especially in those early infant days. So I think that there's a number, there's so much to be done in the American context, that, and there's any number of ways to do it, which is both exciting and also demoralizing because there's such a long way to go.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're talking to Jessica Gross. Her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Back to your calls now. Elle is with us in East Troy. Elle, thanks for calling. What did you want to share with us?
I was just wondering if she had any input on pregnancy loss. I've been pregnant many times and have lost many. And I was wondering how to not be so bitter towards the doctors that wrote me off due to a pre-existing condition that many times, and also how to be happy for people who are around me that are pregnant.
Well, thanks for the call. Do you have any thoughts for Elle, Jessica?
Well, first, I just wanted to say that I'm so sorry for all your losses. It is gut-wrenching. It is so difficult, and that there is absolutely no sugarcoating how hard and painful it is. So I think that that's just one thing to keep in mind, that it's hard, it's painful. I had a loss in between my two daughters, and it just is pretty awful to go through. So I really empathize. I think in terms of coming to a place where you can be happy for other people in your life, again, it is very challenging. I remember in my own life, I had a friend who was due around the same time as my loss, and I could not face her until after her baby was born. It just was too painful. So I think one thing to do is kind of identify for yourself what specific triggers of your pain are. So for me, it was, I just couldn't see this friend while she was pregnant. Once the baby was there, it was fine. I could, you know, get over it. I could enjoy her baby with her. I could be happy for her. But I think it's recognizing that you're, and accepting that you are going to have a mix of complicated emotions, and that that's okay. If you can't bring yourself to be really happy for someone, that's really natural, because especially if you've gone through so many losses, that weighs on you. Again, I talked to many women for my book who really found solace in online communities where people had multiple losses, because they found that unless people in their lives had experienced the exact same thing, they couldn't they could be empathetic, but they couldn't identify. They couldn't really understand that deep pain. And so that might be another way to find community and support. And there's also, you know, in-person groups. Friends of mine are in-person groups that where they discuss multiple losses. So I really hope that you find some peace, because it is so difficult.
I hope that helps. And thanks for being willing to share that with us. Jessica, in just our last minute or so, can you share some advice for moms who feel like, gosh, I'm falling short on what I think being a mom should be? How can they work through that a little bit?
Well, I mean, every day, just try to be kind to yourself. That might sound cheesy, but just anytime you have a self-blaming thought, think, would I say this about my best friend? If you wouldn't say it about your best friend, don't say it about yourself. And every day, again, these are sort of small changes, because often we don't have the agency to change the big things. If we must work a certain number of hours to make ends meet, you know, there are limitations to the sort of changes to our lives that we can make. However, most days I find that there's one thing that is not imperative that I do. I just don't have to do it. I think I might have, I should do it, but it is not necessary. And so if there's one thing on your plate that you can just take off every single day, try to do that, because it will bring you at least a little more time for yourself, a little more peace.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jessica Gross. She writes about parenting for the New York Times opinion section. She talked with Central Times' Rob Ferret last month about her book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're looking for a little order among all the chaos to start the new year, we're helping you get organized and clear the clutter with a couple of pros. Join us. Also, it's Food Friday, and we'll be delivering Chinese takeout right into your kitchen. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.